I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The dean of South Carolina Republican politics, Senator Jim DeMint, says it's now a two-man race between Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich. Gingrich did come out swinging in last night's debate, knocking back CNN moderator John King's first question, asking Gingrich if he wanted to respond to his second wife, Marianne, who told ABC that Gingrich asked her for an open marriage to his now third wife, Callista. Some people are saying John King should have gotten up off the mat and pressed on. We'll take up that question in a moment. But let's check in South Carolina one day before the primary with Adam Beam of the state newspaper there in Columbia. Adam, yesterday a lot of people weren't sure if Newt Gingrich could withstand another story about his marriages. What are you hearing today?
Well, you can, on the ground here talking with voters, you can definitely sense a shift toward Newt Gingrich. And I think a lot of, you know, the stuff that happened to do with his ex-wife, a lot of people already knew that. Already faced a lot of those questions before, so it's not like it's bringing up some kind of new revelations. And you can tell from the response he got last night when he came on the attack of John, the crowd loved it and went wild.
Yeah.
So, and I think one thing to keep in mind about South Carolina is that the Republicans here, they're very, electability means a lot to them. There was a lady at the Mitt Romney rally this morning. She said she wasn't voting for Romney. She was trying to choose between Gingrich or Santorum. She said that the deciding factor for her will be the person she thinks would be more likely to win. So that's something to keep in mind about why Rick Santorum might be falling some here and Gingrich surging, because he's rising in the polls. People think he has a better opportunity to win, so they're going to rally around him.
Well, but then I just have to bring up, there's Jenny Sanford, the ex-wife of South Carolina's now disgraced former governor Mark Sanford, he of the I Was Hiking on the Appalachian Trail when he was actually with his mistress. Jenny Sanford gave an interview last night, and she said she would not vote for Newt Gingrich. You know, so does that carry some weight? She's very popular.
Absolutely, it would carry some weight. There's a question of how many people that message will get to. I don't know how much reach, how many interviews she will do, if that's the only one she'll do. But if she certainly starts getting out and talking a lot, that certainly will have an impact. And then just this morning, the wife of a state representative sent out an email saying she wasn't endorsing anyone, but she wanted to point out about Gingrich how she did not care for his ethics or morals, and she was encouraging people to vote their conscience.
Well, Rick Santorum also tried to poke some holes in Newt Gingrich last night. He called him grandiose. Gingrich responded he was grandiose. He had grandiose ideas, to which today the Romney campaign released a press release. Joe Klein of Time Magazine says it's one of the five best political press releases ever. We'll post it. But it lists Newt Gingrich quotes in which he compares himself to Pericles, Henry Clay, Vince Lombardi, a Viking. And so let's move to Mitt Romney, you know, obviously focusing his attacks on Newt Gingrich now. His worst moment last night had to be when he said maybe, when asked if, as his father before him did, he'd release his tax returns. What are you hearing on the ground about Mitt Romney today?
Well, I don't think people are concerned about what's going to be in his tax returns. Obviously, he's wealthy. You're going to see a lot of money, a lot of income on that. And I don't think people care about that. But they do care about the transparency factor. Why won't you release it? There were a couple of people at Romney's rally today that said, look, I don't think it's going to be a big concern, but you got to do the right thing and release it. And it is kind of, I think, beginning to frustrate some Romney supporters here that he's been asked this question several times, and he doesn't really seem to have a good answer for it yet. You think that by this time he would have figured out a good, solid answer to that question, but last night, you're right, he stammered, he stumbled, and he ended up laughing at himself about it as he was getting booed.
Well, and it's interesting because he must have known he was going to be getting that question.
Absolutely. I mean, you would think that he would have practiced it. I mean, you've got to ask it in the debate. He got to ask it that morning at a rally at his headquarters of supporters.
Yeah.
So if his supporters are asking him, you got to think that people, you know, that the debate was coming.
Well, let's say Rick Santorum, Ron Paul, both very feisty last night. Rick Santorum in particular had a memorable line. Speaking of Newt Gingrich, he said at one point, you just never know when something's going to pop. but then you went to a Rick Santorum event. So what are you feeling on the ground about his following?
Well, I went to this Rick Santorum event. It was right at the foot of the Arthur Ravenel Bridge, that iconic bridge that spans the waterway there in Charleston. And I thought, okay, this is great. I'm going to try to find some Santorum people to respond to Rick Perry's endorsement of Gingrich. And the first six people that I talked to, none of them were South Carolina voters. One was from Iowa, one was from London, four were from Pennsylvania. So I finally found two people to talk to, and they were just there on a school field trip with their kids. One was a Paul supporter, the other was hadn't decided yet, but was decided leaning toward Mitt Romney. Mm-hmm. So I think, again, that just kind of shows there's no real momentum surge for him here. And I think, you know, his attacks in the debate last night, Santorum did really well. I mean, he did a good job of contrasting himself, especially with the healthcare stuff. But I think it's just a simple thing of it might be too little, too late.
Well, and yet there seems to be a lot of energy from Ron Paul supporters. Furman University political science professor Danielle Vinson told us that they were the most energized.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you'll see he'll have a rally here in Columbia tonight at Jillian's. It's a popular night spot here in Columbia. I guarantee you that it will be packed and it'll be raucous. But, you know, he does have these vocal supporters. They're constantly calling me out of the blue, just cold calling, telling me they've never voted before, and they know they're going to vote this year because he really inspires them. But that doesn't translate to poll numbers for some reason. He seems to be always stuck at the 12 to 15%, and that's probably what he's going to get on Saturday.
Well, we will see. Adam Beam of the state newspaper there in Columbia, South Carolina, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So, as we said, the debate last night opened with CNN moderator John King asking Newt Gingrich, if he wanted to respond to his former wife's statement that he'd asked her for an open marriage. Gingrich was ready.
And I am frankly astounded that CNN would take trash like that and use it to open a presidential debate.
As you noted, Mr. Speaker, this story did not come from our network. As you also know, it is the subject of conversation on the campaign. I get your point. I take your point.
John, it was repeated by your network. You chose to start the debate with it. Don't try to blame somebody else.
CNN's David Gergen said this is one of the most explosive moments we've ever seen in debate history. Observers say Newt Gingrich slam dunked it. But New Yorker writer John Cassidy writes, King should have punched back with questions like, if you're so concerned about privacy, why during the Monica Lewinsky affair did you insist on holding President Clinton to account for his personal life? He was referring to 1998 when a Speaker of the House, while he was having his own affair with his current wife, Callista, Newt Gingrich called for the impeachment of President Bill Clinton.
There is no administration in American history with less moral authority than the Clinton-Gore administration.
Charles Bierbauer is former CNN political reporter. He's now dean and professor at the College of Mass Communications and Information Studies at the University of South Carolina. Charles, John King in a tough moment, but your thoughts on all this?
Well, John conceded that this was a question that he would be damned if he did and damned if he didn't ask it, and yet it was the question that was certainly the moment of the day with Gingrich's second wife making these statements, making these comments, which were on other networks. So I think John had to ask the question. I've known John for a long time. He's a very astute political correspondent. What he may not have anticipated is quite what the reaction was.
Go ahead.
No, I was just thinking that as I watched that, I sensed that John wanted to ask that question early, get it out of the way, and move on to some of the more substantive issues in terms of economy and jobs and all the other elements that are out there, but knew that he had to ask it.
Well, Newt Gingrich has also, you know, punched back at other moderators. We remember Monday's debate with Juan Williams, who did press Newt Gingrich in his line of questioning. Also in November, moderator Maria Bartiromo was booed, but she kept asking the question of the line she wanted to ask. And you have been thinking about other times in debates where moderators have stood up.
Well, just to that point, John asked the question. Gingrich said, no, I don't want to, but I will respond, and then launched into attack mode. John interceded at one point and said, but this story is out there, it's elsewhere. And Gingrich continued on attack mode to press on at that point when you'd already consumed maybe the first 4 or 5 minutes of the debate might have been to actually overplay that particular aspect. I think that the former speaker said it's false, and that was his substantive response. Everything else was pyrotechnic.
Right.
I don't know that there was a need to go farther with it at that point. We'd certainly heard enough from Mr. Gingrich, and my sense would actually be that John Wisely moved on to something else.
Well, Karen Tomalady agrees with you. She's national political correspondent for The Washington Post. She's there on a cell phone from Charleston, South Carolina. Karen, you think that would have, if John King had pressed back, as others have in the past, that might have gotten him into a quagmire?
Well, I think this is not a debate between John King and Newt Gingrich. This is a debate among the candidates. And so I think, you know, Gingrich was prepared for the question. I think he welcomed the question, actually. And then it was time to move on. It would have otherwise become, like I said, a debate between the moderator and the candidate instead of among the candidates.
Well, again, a dissenting voice belongs to John Cassidy in The New Yorker. He's writing today that without pressing back about the ex-wife's allegations, including the affirmation that Newt Gingrich doesn't have the moral character to be president, John King allowed Newt Gingrich to dismiss them as unfounded and get in a few more shots at media, which has been his tactic in debates. But putting that aside, Karen, Charles, we have you both there in South Carolina. We've been hearing that whatever your feelings about the debate and the moderator, it seems to have worked for Newt Gingrich. Karen, are you hearing that on the ground?
I think it has. And in fact, Newt Gingrich, I did an interview with him in October where he told me that he really thought the single moment when his campaign began to turn around was in some of his earlier skirmishes with moderators, including Chris Wallace of Fox News. I mean, he sees these as very much working to his advantage. And I do think, especially with the Republican electorate beating up on CNN, is something that people are going to cheer.
Yeah, but Charles, Newt Gingrich may have to face the general electorate, you know, if he continues on. Just briefly, in the minute or so we have, your thoughts.
Well, the general electorate is a different thing. It crosses a broader spectrum than does those who are going to vote in a Republican election. It's a different dynamic, and there's the old maxim that you run to the extreme to get nominated, and you run to the center to get elected. So Mr. Gingrich or Mr. Romney, whomever, will have to be much more appealing to moderates and independents to win in November. On the point of the media, the media have to be thick-skinned. We don't necessarily care if the candidate turns on us. We ask the questions and take the consequences.
Yeah.
But it's up to the public to then judge, was Gingrich right, or was he over the top? As Karen points out, it's not a debate between the moderator and the candidate. Is really among the candidates, and I think if you reflect back, Senator Santorum came back on that question of morality and character.
Well, actually, Charles, I have to point out, you said Mr. Romney or Mr. Gingrich or Mr. Paul or Mr. Santorum. This has been that kind of a primary season, still ready to unfold. Karen Tumulty reporting that Ron Paul's surprising appeal for religious conservatives is catching her eye. That's Charles Bierbauer, former CNN political reporter and now at the College of Mass Communications Information at University of South Carolina, and Karen Tumulty, of course, of The Washington Post. Thank you both for being our eyes and ears in South Carolina. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Pakistan's Prime Minister Yusuf Raza Gilani is due back before the country's Supreme Court on February 1st to defend his decision not to reopen a corruption case against his boss, Pakistan's President Asif Ali Zardari. Speaking before the court yesterday, the Prime Minister said the president enjoys immunity as long as he's in power. How serious is this face-off? Well, if found in contempt, the Prime Minister could be banned from office. And here's a line from a BBC report. This standoff between the government, the judiciary, and the military threatens to topple the Prime Minister's government. The BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones is covering the story from Islamabad. He joins us. And, Owen, this gets very complicated, but the corruption case the Prime Minister is being asked to open is against President Zardari and his late wife, the former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. This dates way back to before she returned from exile to run again in 2008, when she was, of course, assassinated. And it's funny, the charges, in a way, are tied to her return. Sketch them out for us.
back in the 90s, she was in government and her husband was a cabinet minister, and they were accused of taking kickbacks. And there were lots of cases, but the one that got the most furthest advanced was this one in Switzerland. It went as far as a conviction. And then Benazir Bhutto and Asif Ali Zardari appealed, and so that conviction was set aside during the appeal, but then he got elected president and became immune, so the whole thing was dropped by the Swiss. But the Supreme Court here have been saying, no, that doesn't matter, just crack on. Let's get the Swiss restarting it. You must send a letter to the Swiss, because the Swiss won't do it without a letter, saying we want the case reopened. And that's what the Prime Minister hasn't done, and failing to follow the order of the court in that respect ended up with him getting this contempt charge.
And I just want to pick up that thread. I said that this case was tied to Benazir Bhutto's return from exile. And as you said, when that charge against her, when the Swiss authorities sort of abandoned the charges against her, that was part of the amnesty that allowed Bhutto to return, run for re-election. And of course, we know she was assassinated. Now, as you said, her husband is the president, the prime minister, claiming he has immunity from prosecution while he's in office. Let's listen to an exchange you had with the prime minister's lawyer after yesterday's hearing.
You said in court you'd write a letter after the president. A letter could be written after the president has left office.
No longer the president. That is true. That is the correct constitutional position. As long as he's president, he has sovereign immunity under Article 248, sub-Article 3.
So, Owen Bennett Jones, it gets kind of complicated, but they're saying we're not going to write the letter now, wait till he's not president. But why is this all coming up now?
The legal case is fiendish. So the bigger picture is that the judiciary is newly assertive in Pakistan because the Supreme Court Chief Justice was returned to office having been sacked under the military dictator General Musharraf. He was returned to office on the back of a popular protest movement which gave him huge legitimacy and authority. And the court, which had really withered away in recent decades, you could say, had suddenly reinvigorated and is now trying to insist on the rule of law and make the government submit to its will. The second thing that's happening is that the army is extremely upset with the government because of attempts the government made to rein in the army and actually calling it on US administration help and military help, trying to say to the people in the United States, look, we're the civilians, help us control the army, because the army is always, basically bullies civilian governments here. So there are those two pressures from the army and from the judiciary on the government, and it's been pretty hot for the government in recent weeks.
Well, and it gets a little deeper because there was apparently a secret memo sent to Washington last year asking help to stop a suspected military coup. It was a memo that was supposedly passed to the U.S. By Pakistan's former ambassador to the U.S., Hussein Haqqani, who now says he's afraid he's going to be killed if he leaves his sanctuary inside the prime minister's residence. It gets very, very deep. But is there a suspicion on the part of the military that the Pakistan government has reached out to the U.S. to stop a suspected coup?
That's absolutely true. This is this whole Memogate scandal, and that's what's left Hussein Haqqani in this incredible situation where he is literally holed up inside Prime Minister's house. I went to see him there a few weeks ago. Amazing situation. He wouldn't even come out onto the lawn. And then you've got the Prime Minister being surprisingly defiant. I mean, just making statements saying the army should stay in its box, basically. And, we are the civilians and we should control the army. And the thing about the army here, which you may not appreciate, is that they're just not used to this. I mean, I went to see some general the other day. What the Prime Minister said in any Western country would be entirely normal. But the military outlook here is such, this general was just saying, he's being incredibly offensive. it's just unacceptable.
Well, we're used to tensions between the government and the military. We're used to turmoil in Pakistan. But Owen Bennett-Jones, we've just delivered a lot of information to people. Put it in context. How much more turmoil is there than normal? Is there a chance that the government could collapse? What's your sense?
Well, my sense is that, one of the things that why it's difficult to assess this sort of thing is that when you study American history, European history, these sort of constitutional crises where basically you've got the government up against the court and the two fighting out where their authority begins and ends, that these are major crises which happen about once a century and they determine the future progress of the country, and you study them at school afterwards, the sort of thing you study at school. These things happen in Pakistan about every 2 years. So, in general terms, the government, which did look in big trouble last week, has remained very united, utterly defiant, and has seen off the trouble at least until February the 1st, when there's another court hearing, which could change everything once again.
Just a quick question, Owen Bennett-Jones. It sounds like the entire government and the military of Pakistan is consumed with this issue, which makes one wonder, the other things we think Pakistan, well, the U.S. ally, are doing, maybe tracking terrorists, isn't happening.
Perhaps most Pakistani citizens would think more germane is the fact that they're not looking after the jobs, the price rises, the gas shortages, the power cuts that are making factories close down. You know, the whole progress of nearly 200 million people rests on the efficiency of the Pakistan government, and it's not delivering. I mean, I've been talking to a lot of people who are, you know, labourers and people who are not on big salaries, $2-3 a day, that kind of thing, and they're absolutely distraught. They're frustrated at the fact that, I mean, I have to say, they do watch all this on the there are hundreds of 24-hour news channels here now, and they all watch it with great interest. I mean, it is a sort of soap opera quality to it. But basically, people are extremely desperate, frankly, for proper government. And they haven't had it for many years. So there are, I'm sure, frustrations in the United States, but much greater frustrations, to be honest, here in Pakistan.
Sure. The BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones speaking to us from Islamabad. Owen, thanks as always.
Yeah, thanks very much.
1.3 million gallons of fuel have been delivered to icebound Nome, Alaska, finally. And as you know, it wasn't easy. We recall those pictures of the Coast Guard cutter, the Healy, trying to break the ice of the Bering Sea so that a Russian tanker could get close enough to Nome to pump the fuel. Well, the story highlights an aging infrastructure, ports that are too shallow, icebreakers too old, and a region maybe not as equipped for new realities as, say, Russia is. Joining us from the NPR studios in Washington is Margaret Chris Hobson, a reporter for the online environment and energy newsletter GreenWire. And so, Margie, we know even after the tanker got close to Nome, it still had to stretch a sort of gas line across the ice to pump the fuel to the docks to the waiting people there. The port just isn't deep enough, and the Coast Guard doesn't have the resources it needs?
No, it doesn't. Right now they have one icebreaker. Alaska is a very, very large area, has a lot of inlets, and as global warming increases the open season for the waters in the Arctic, you're going to see a lot more ship traffic. But we have one icebreaker. We have very few resources up in the Arctic area. And we have two other icebreakers that are larger that might be able to help down the road. But one of them has been decommissioned, and the other one is under repairs until, I believe, the last date was 2013. So right now, with more traffic coming in, we are in kind of a bad spot.
We'll talk a little more about the climate change and global warming, because it means that ice is melting so that in the summer time there's far more commercial traffic and people are wanting to get in there and maybe, you know, boost industry, but they need things like, you know, literally gas stations for ships. You know, they need ports and things. On the other hand, it's still ice bound in the winter. So you have this, you know, much more traffic, but what? Not enough ability to get in there and build things to accommodate the traffic?
It's more money than time to do it. Of course, it would take longer because of the, you'd have to do it during the summertime period. There was an Arctic Council, which is a coalition of Arctic nations. They came out with a report that said by mid-century, the Arctic could be nearly free of ice in the summertime. That's an amazing thing if you think about the amount of ice that's up there even still now during the summer. But we don't have the facilities because just haven't built it over time. There was some consideration various times of building a deep water port, but it's expensive. Putting those kinds of resources in require either the government to put in or the businesses to put in, and it's a lot of money.
Well, yes, a deep water port you'd have to dredge. That would take years. Onshore harbors are also hard. There's been talk about offshore, you know, harboring. But, you know, what are the issues that might stand in the way of this besides money? Are there environmental concerns?
Oh, definitely there are environmental concerns. And the native communities up there have a lot of concerns, too. They still depend on subsistence marine activity, you know, the fishing, going out and getting the whales. Their communities are very small. They have enough water and wastewater and housing facilities for themselves and maybe a couple of guests. I was up there a couple summers ago and ended up staying in a school building because that's the only facility that they had for me. Yeah. It would be hard if you have anyone coming through just for the environmental side, for the housing side, for the community side. Environmentally, we have a lot of endangered species that are up there or like critical habitat that's up there. I wasn't able to get in my story into as much on the environmental side because I think people are still exploring that. You know, they've got to figure it out. Nobody knows.
But staying with that, the question of the environment, here you have, as you said, because of the shrinking of the Arctic ice cap, you have much more traffic, shipping routes opening up. Call for more fuel and harbors and deep water ports, but I would assume that this would also impact the call for more drilling.
Oh, it is. This summer, you'll probably see Shell Oil begin to do some exploratory drilling in the Chukchi Sea. There's never been any, in the past, but very, very a long time ago, they did a little bit of exploratory drilling. Now you have a number of different companies all sort of chomping at the bit because of some estimates that have come out that there are enormous amount of oil that's underneath the Arctic. So all of the nations on the Arctic coast are really looking to start to develop that oil. And, you know, the industry is very, very interested. Let's put it that way.
Well, and it really underscores that climate change really, really is happening as it impacts that region. Margaret Chris Hobson covers environmental and energy issues for the online newsletter Greenwire on how climate change is impacting areas in Alaska. Margaret, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here we go. 5, 6, 7, 8.
In a small performance studio at New York's 92nd Street Y, 16 20-something dancers ping-pong around the room, alternately crashing into, lifting, or pushing each other away.
Okay, all right, now that was better.
It's chaos, but it's carefully choreographed by dancer Robin Becker.
I saw a lot of... you know, intense, and it doesn't read. What reads is...
The 7 members of the Manhattan-based Robin Becker dance troupe, along with 9 students from Hofstra University, where Robin teaches, are getting in a quick rehearsal and sound check before tonight's performance.
Could you maybe go a millisecond faster?
Yeah.
So that traffic jam's not there?
Yes.
Cool.
They mingle on the floor, trying to map out the scene. It's complicated, potentially dangerous.
Okay, instead of going over so far, just try that. Wow. Yeah.
It also describes, in dance, a student protest that happened before they were born, on October 17, 1967, at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Here's how the campus police described it at the time.
A squad of 50 Madison policemen were called to the scene and were met by an angry, vicious mob of 300 or more protesters.
On the same day, there was a battle in Vietnam. Here's a news account of that event.
The 1st Infantry Division, in a costly, bitter battle with the Viet Cong, has reportedly smashed a guerrilla plan to overrun Saigon itself.
Troops on the ground were furious. It wasn't a victory. It was an ambush. And those student protesters, they were peaceful. Reporter David Marinus set the record straight in his 2003 book, They Marched Into Sunlight, writing that in 1967, the U.S. was 2 years into the war, 500,000 troops in Vietnam, 14,000 had already been killed. General Westmoreland wanted troops to pursue the Viet Cong deeper into the jungle. David tells what happens to soldiers from the fabled Black Lion Battalion when they did.
They were out in the jungle about 44 miles northwest of Saigon on what they then called a search and destroy mission. You would go out into the jungle and find the Viet Cong or the North Vietnamese and fix them in position and destroy them. This battalion walked off into the sunlight, into the jungle, and unwittingly walked into a horrendous ambush. The Viet Cong were laying in wait for them. They knew they were there because the Americans were so heavy and moving around the jungle. They set up the ambush, more than 1,000 Viet Cong against about 140 American troops. Mm-hmm. And for a few hours, these American troops suffered the worst that man can suffer, 60 killed and 60 wounded out of that group.
Yeah. What was happening in Madison, Wisconsin at almost the same time?
One of the symbols of the war on college campuses was the Dow Chemical Company, the makers of napalm and of Agent Orange. And so Dow Chemical Company came to the University of Wisconsin to recruit. The anti-war movement knew they were coming, set up a protest, which they thought would be an act of civil disobedience by sitting down in the hallway of the Commerce Building where the recruiting would go on. And the Madison police stormed into the hallway and started clubbing students in what became the first violent confrontation between students and police in the anti-war movement.
Yeah. Well, David Marinus, in his review in 2003, the late, great David Halberstam says, your book is one of the finest war reporting ever. But he also wondered about pairing it with a college protest. Now, we should say years later, 4 students would be killed at Kent State. But
David Halberstam was a mentor and hero of mine, and he tried to talk me out of writing the book because of that. I disagreed with him then, and I do now. I'm not trying to make a moral equivalency between the battle and the protest, but they were all young people making difficult choices, utterly different worlds that nonetheless revolve around the same thing.
So you have violence and anger in Madison, Wisconsin, and a mauling, slaughter in Vietnam. What did you think when Robin Becker first approached you and said, I'd like to choreograph that?
Well, I was thrilled because this book is about physicality, and it's about young being betrayed by the old and the questions of what defines bravery and courage. And I was completely blown away by the way she translated it.
And really thank you and honor your service, and be very glad you're here.
Back at the 92nd Street Y, Robin Becker welcomes any veterans who might be in attendance, as does the audience. Then her dance, Into Sunlight, begins, and we're transported back in time.
The book begins with a group of soldiers on a ship sailing into the unknown from San Diego to Vietnam, landing at the port of Vung Tau, marching off the ship into the sunlight. And Robin has devised this wonderful choreography where her seven wonderful dancers are in this clump, sort of and moving across the stage in slow motion with one of the dancers, Yoko, on top of them, walking on their backs as they go across the ocean. And it just evoked to me that whole sensation of sailing into the unknown. And as soon as I saw that, I thought, I wasn't sure that I would feel the book in the dance, and immediately I did. There's another part of the book called Hollander's Run about a major, Donald Hollander, who was an All-American football player, who was in a helicopter as the battle was underway. And he landed the helicopter, and just like he had been on the West Point football team, he just got off and ran toward the battle and was gunned down and killed. Chaz's redoing of that scene I thought was very powerful. All of them evoked something, whether it was Diane Sikorsky, this young woman from Milwaukee who has a dream that her brother Danny shows up and he's missing his stomach, and then the next day he's killed in this battle. And there's several points of the dance that evoke that. The chaos and uncertainty of the students in Madison as they're trying to protest also moved me. All of them did. You know, there's one wonderful scene in the dance where a man just sits there like he's a gravestone.
Yeah.
And one of the women dancers, Yoko, sort of moves around him, evoking sorrow in a way that no words that I could write do.
She almost tries to make love to this immobile.
It is very erotic and sad and powerful at the same time.
She ends up taking his lifeless arm and putting it around her. Into Sunlight, the Robin Becker Dance Troupe's interpretation of David Marinus's book about a battle and a protest in 1967. By the way, that book also the subject of the documentary 2 Days in October. When we come back, what did the vets in the audience think here and now? Welcome back. This past summer at New York's 92nd Street Y, the Robin Becker Dance Troupe rehearsed the final scenes of Robin's adaptation of author David Marinus's book, Into the Sunlight. It tells of two events on one day in 1967, an anti-war protest at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and an ambush in Vietnam in which 60 soldiers were killed. But as her dance concludes, Robin has them rise and walk, some carrying the dead, into the sunlight.
Those of you who are up, just keep seeing if you can feel a little light on your face, like just there you go, you let it hit you.
But before that powerful ending, the dancers lay on the ground in carnage.
there's a section of the dance we call the Wall of Carnage. I wanted to show just the horror of it, but I didn't want to do something corny like do fake fighting. So we started to do just this really slow motion, distorted movement that you really have to look at the terrible positions for a while.
You see a hand push a face for a full 30 seconds, and then the head is completely turned and contorted.
Mm-hmm. David Marinus, when he saw it, calls it the Guernica scene.
As in the Spanish painting.
Yeah.
That's what it reminded me of, a beautiful frozen tableau that to me sort of evoked that same sense of the way that war bends lives into these cruel angles, as a poet put it.
You seem very moved.
I am very moved.
Why? What, I mean, it's both obvious and what is it?
You know, the tragedy and the dignity, both. I think I got chills in places I've never, like, I got chills through my entire being. I'm so
tired. What have you seen from today's military as they come to the performance?
One man did say that he came to the performance determined to not like it. And in fact, he...
Why did he say that?
He didn't want to find one beautiful thing about war. And he said, and instead, I'm sitting in my seat and I've been given the gift of a great catharsis.
What is your full name?
Joe Clemente.
Clemente, Ralph DeMatthews.
Ralph DeMatthews.
Yeah, I joined the Irvington Center and went down to that.
Joe Clemente and Ralph DeMatthews are two Vietnam combat veterans who were in the audience. Joe's niece is one of the dancers. She dedicates her performance in part to him.
Right under Lisa Clemente.
Oh, okay.
Right down here on the bottom. Lisa dedicates this performance to veterans Corporal Joseph Clemente Jr., 1st Marine Air Wing Marble Mountain, Vietnam.
The dance has unleashed a flood of memories for both men.
It brought me to tears at some point. The images and the movement, it was beautiful. The leaving, when the first movement they made going across the ocean, and it brought me back to leaving from Seattle and getting on the plane. And just one image that came in my head. The Marines got on board in uniform, ready to get off and fight. And I remember this one image that stays in my mind all my life, is this beautiful blonde woman just hanging on to this man in uniform, not wanting to let go. And I always kind of wondered if he got through it or what. And then that whole 12 hours it took us to get there was kind of like very quiet in the plane, very quiet. Yeah. And then landing in a firefight. And I remember that woman opening the door, and it was like a punch, the humidity. And it was like I backed up. I said, I don't want to do this, but I had no choice. And there was a firefight going on at the same time.
Is that okay to have a dance provoke those feelings?
I think that's fine. It's mean they did their art correctly.
Of all the dances that I've watched my niece do, this is the one that I've understood the most.
Yeah, yeah. And I haven't even read the book. Yeah, it's on my list. I live in Hoboken, and it's in the library, and that's the next book I'm going to read.
You're going to read the book?
Because I didn't even notice two events happened. I was 17, a child.
Yeah, I was 18.
Yeah.
What does that mean to you, that there was this violent event on a college campus on the same day there was this ambush? Not that they're comparable, but... What does that mean?
I didn't know what was going on, but now thinking back, I commend those people for doing that.
For protesting.
Yes, I didn't know. I mean, I had no idea.
We hated the protesters in America. I didn't have nothing to say about tonight's dance. I had a lot to say when I was younger about when I came home and treated like an animal. And that never leaves.
Yeah. What did you feel watching the dance?
I actually felt like I was there. I was watching a woman cry. On a couple of rows ahead of me, I actually was crying myself. The choppers?
No. Yeah.
The choppers definitely were in the background. Oh, yeah. They were always there.
You don't forget that noise. The largest helicopter blades, 67 feet or whatever, that walk, 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 walk. And I knew these men were going out to perchance not come back. And when the middle of the night and they came back, or, you know, it was the rescue guys, Hueys, the dust-offs, they called them, that take the death, the dead, and the wounded away.
And the people dying on the floor and carrying him off. Yeah. That was very touching. Yeah. Very touching.
Yeah. I almost left the 92nd Street Y without talking to the young Robin Becker dancers. After all, what could they know about Vietnam? Silly me. Okay.
Well, here's Lisa. How old are you?
I'm going to be 29, actually, next month. So
this is ancient history in many ways.
Yes. We read the book, and then having my uncle, who's a Vietnam vet. And
what did you get? Joe's standing right here. What did you get from Joe?
Well,
actually, any question she asked me, I would answer just about.
I was asking him if he had any photos, so he had some photos. And it was amazing to see him, like, basically my younger, much younger than my age then, but it was his youth, his...
They were all so young. The students were young.
Everybody was 18 at that time.
And but the youth behind their faces and their smiles and them, you know, playing around. I watched a video that he had on while he was in Vietnam, and his buddies and them are, you know, just having a good time. And this rapport, which you actually see in the movement, the men's trio, you see that they're, you know, these guys are just, they're boys.
The men's trio where they're sort of like, shadow boxing each other, and they're like puppies, and they're rolling around on the ground, and then they're carrying each other off because they all don't make it.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody does.
And then there was dancer Paul Monahan. He danced in the men's trio.
Well, actually, my father was in Vietnam.
How did that form what you did out there?
Well, in many ways, I got to tell his story, and my father wasn't somebody who really ever discussed it.
And what is his story? I mean, what part do you think you conveyed?
Honestly, I don't know. I don't know. It's kind of a mystery. It's kind of like what's not said, not talked about, what's not said. But at the same time, it becomes a part of your heritage in a way. I mean, to this day, he won't even get on a helicopter.
Has he come to see this?
No, he hasn't.
Do you think it would be too much?
Possibly, for sure. Yeah. But like, that's the thing. By doing this, I get to honor him as well as other soldiers.
I'm wondering, too, if this helped you find the narrative that he can't tell you, because this role is also enabling you to have the conversation with other vets that you can't have with your dad.
Yeah, I never thought about that way, but yeah, absolutely. Actually, a number of vets just came up to me tonight and thanked me, and it's like, what, you're thanking me? It's so humbling, really. I can only say thank you.
This music is from Brotherhood, that moment in the dance when Paul and two other dancers depict soldiers frolicking just before falling. By the way, the score for Robin Becker's Into Sunlight is by Chris Lastavica, music direction by Arthur Solari. It will be performed this weekend at Georgetown University with a question and answer with David Moranis. For more, go to hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Join us again here and now.